come right in, pull up a chair. It's time once again to gather around the gaming table with your friends at The Gaming Gang, proudly sponsored by Victory Point Games. This time around, Elliot will be reviewing Giza from Mayfair Games and Wizwar from Fantasy Flight Games. Jeff will be reviewing Mundus Novus from Asmodee Editions and Franco-Prussian War 40 from Victory Point Games. We'll have news, views, and much, much more on this episode of The Gaming Gang. Now here's your hosts, Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller.
Hi, I'm Jeff McAleer.
And I am Elliot Miller.
And we are back once again.
Yes, we are. Hey, 2 weeks have gone by.
It didn't feel like 2 weeks. It seemed long this time around. Usually when we record a show, it's, wow, the show's up already? We got another show to do? And you know what? I think it might be part of it was that we're not doing the Daily Dope anymore.
Yeah, well, that could very well be part of it.
Yes. So it wasn't like I felt like I had a microphone in front of me every single day.
I have to tell you, right now, I feel no regrets from not doing the Daily Dope anymore. So
I don't either. I actually did some digging around into our numbers on the server to see what's what. I was very, very surprised by the number of people who are downloading our shows. It was a lot more than I originally thought.
Right. I mean, 10 billion?
Yes, whoa. Exactly. I couldn't believe that the server that we run off of couldn't even calculate it. I think it was beyond a Google. We are getting between, on average, 3,000 to 5,000 downloads for each of our programs.
Yeah,
I was like, what?
That's pretty
like,
cool.
Seriously? Because it's very tough to actually track numbers without digging into your server. In all honesty, it just wasn't something I felt was important enough for me to devote time into.
Right.
So I just kind of went with like the Google numbers from the analytics, but it wouldn't count the people through iTunes or the RSS feeds and things like that. It would just be the people who went directly to the podcast page itself. So I was thinking we were getting, you know, 1,000 downloads of each show. But jumping back to the Daily Dope, we were getting anywhere from about 150 to 200 downloads a show, which is cool, but still just it really was taking away from the website itself.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
No, I know
you had a stronger opinion on that, but I agreed with you. It really did seem like we were suffering in the long run because of the Daily Show. Not Jon Stewart's Daily Show, our Daily Show. So what's been cooking?
Let's see. Hey, I got a chance to go to the Museum of Science and Industry.
Yes, you recently put up a post about the U-505 submarine.
Yeah. Went there to see the new the opening of the new Mythbusters explosive exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we get there and you had to be there 27 hours ago to get in line. Uh-huh.
Sure, right. Best the Beatles came to town.
Exactly. It was all of them. I mean, Grant and Tori and Jamie and Adam. And Carrie Byron. They're all there. They're all signing autographs. They seemed really nice. The best I got was pictures of them signing autographs.
For other people, yes.
Uh-huh. Right.
From like 75 yards away, you get this photograph. It's these tiny little specks.
You know, I'm sure they'll listen to the podcast. They'll fly me out to L.A. and
yeah, they're going to sit there and really regret that they had missed that opportunity to meet Elliot Miller.
We missed Elliot Miller?
What the hell wrong with us? I can't believe it, you fools.
But we also walked around and looked at a bunch of other stuff. They have this new cool science storm section where there's this 40-foot like fake tornado that they generate.
Bolt of lightning.
They do have one of those big Tesla coils mounted near the ceiling that sounds like Frankenstein's lab.
Funny you mention Nikolai Tesla because I'm listening to an audiobook, which is a biography of him.
Really?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I was fairly familiar with him. Oh, especially in that movie, The Prestige. You have seen that, right?
Yes, yes, I have
David
seen
Bowie
that.
Plays it. He creates the machine that duplicates things. Yeah. Oh, shoot. I just gave away the ending in the movie. Sorry. Oh, sorry if I spoiled it for somebody who hasn't
seen
it.
Spoiler alert. A little
good, late. Good movie.
Yeah, it was a good movie. That was the one with Christian Bale?
Yes. Okay. And Michael Caine is in it. And so is
Hugh Jackman?
Yeah, Hugh Jackman. So that was a really good movie. I enjoyed that movie.
Yeah, that was really good.
Although I have to admit, some people I know didn't understand the ending.
Oh, well, yeah. There's some people who don't understand anything.
I guess. I didn't think it was that difficult to figure out. I thought it was pretty good. A little plot twist at the end.
Yeah, it's hard to come up with a good plot twist nowadays since you can't guess beforehand.
That is true. It seems more now than ever I can be sitting there watching something and say out loud to somebody, okay, how much you want to bet blah, blah, blah is going to happen.
Right. Oh, and my God. So it was the sled.
Shush! Stop it! One of my all-time favorite movies. That one and Casablanca. Citizen Kane and Casablanca are my favorites.
That's very good.
There are quite a lot of people who don't like Citizen Kane.
Really?
Although, yeah, most people agree it's the greatest film ever made. Yet there are people out there who do not like it. My mom is one. My mom doesn't think it's a very good movie. Don't know what to tell you. So anyway, back to your U-505.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So we were walking around the U-505 exhibit. They have a tour that you can pay a little extra for. And mm-hmm. walk around inside it.
Sure.
And it's a guided tour. They have U.S. veterans from World War II available in the exhibit and giving the tours, which is pretty cool because they talk about it. This is all knowledgeable stuff to them.
Sure.
And
I think there's very many of those submariners left.
Probably not. But these weren't just specifically submarine. It was just anybody in the Navy.
Oh, okay.
That they had at the exhibit.
Sure.
But they knew a whole bunch of stuff. Allie saw this torpedo that they had taken apart.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, you know, I wonder at what point in this is the actual explosive? And then the guy stopped by and said, oh, well, it's over here. And here's where the payload was. And here's where blah, blah.
Right.
It was pretty
Isn't
cool.
the main tube of the torpedo, isn't that where the explosive is located? The primer and the trigger are located in the nose.
Yeah. But I didn't know that these things ran on compressed air.
Mm-hmm. That's why you see that trail of bubbles.
Mm-hmm. Something I did not know.
Very
so you learn something new every day.
Or at least we try to.
Uh-huh. So that's why I put up the post, because I'm not sure how many people really have seen a German U-boat.
Or even had the opportunity to go inside.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know for sure, but I always thought, living in Chicago, that the U-505 was actually the only captured German U-boat that was on display anywhere in the United States.
Yes, and you're, well, all of North America even.
You okay.
Correct. I went and looked it up.
I wasn't sure, but I thought that was the case.
And it's the only one of that class
mm-hmm.
in the world.
That's so. Still open to the public?
Yeah. And they only have three or four worldwide.
Right.
Yeah. You know what? The other one thing I was going to mention is we signed up as members again because it's mm-hmm. a lot easier to get in and a lot cheaper
sure.
in the long run.
Right.
And coming up next month is the camp-in. For the members, where you go
right,
and you
yes.
stay overnight at the museum.
Yes. And then the creature from the relic comes out and kills everybody. Yeah. Yes.
I was thinking about bringing my recorder and trying to do some EVP capturing while I'm there. Because you're there all night. You get to wander
yeah.
around. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, jumping back real quick, you were talking about the U-505.
Mm-hmm.
If anyone out there has never seen the German movie Das Boot, or The Boat,
mm-hmm.
definitely check it out, especially the director's edition. Awesome movie. It's a fantastic movie. It's one of my favorites. And it really shows what those German crews went through during World War II. And most of them were not Nazis. Very, very cool movie. So if you haven't seen Das Boot, definitely check it out. One thing I did want to mention that I was able to do since the last show is introduce my friend Nicole to Twilight Struggle.
Very cool.
And yes, it was very cool. She had never played any sorts of games. In fact, when I had talked with her about what we do with the website and the show and things like that, automatically the assumption was, our, you know, like Monopoly, you know, those
right.
kind of games.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, no, not really. So I actually went over and I brought a few games with. She's really into politics and social issues and things like that.
Yeah.
And I thought she would really dig checking out Twilight Struggle. So I showed her how to play. And of course, the first turn was kind of getting used to what the cards do and how to go about doing things. And we didn't play the game to completion, but we got to the fifth turn. And I'll tell you what, you know, I was very impressed. She picked it up right away. I was playing the U.S. It was only the second time I've gotten a chance to play the United States. And at one point, the Soviets had 14 victory points.
Wow.
And it was
nice.
Not looking good.
In her first game, not bad.
In her first game. Unfortunately, by the fifth turn, things had, of course, changed. And it was the U.S. who had, I believe, like a dozen victory points. And I probably would have won that game. But it was still up in the air. I was pretty weak in Europe. And we had gotten to the point where the mid-war deck was already in play. All the scoring cards were pretty much back into the mix. And she could have probably, if she played her cards right, got me in Europe and just turned it all around again. But she really thought it was a cool game.
Huh.
And I thought that was very nice to finally get an opportunity to introduce someone who knows nothing about any of the stuff that we tackle and show them, hey, you know, there are some games out there that are really engaging. And it's not just Monopoly or
Pictionary. How about Pictionary?
Yes, right. Pictionary. Ugh. Yeah, don't get me going. And for her to see, wow, you know, there's a lot of different stuff out there. And I think from time to time, I'm actually going to have somebody new I can game with.
That's cool. Bringing gamers into the gaming world, one game at a time.
That's right.
Something like that.
Yeah, well, bringing people into the hobby one gamer at a time.
There you go. Thank you.
Good way to do it.
Hey, when 1989 comes out. She might like
yes.
that, too.
I'm looking forward to it. It's been delayed, as far as I know, but I believe it should start shipping in April.
Oh, cool. I'm looking forward to that, too.
Yeah, I'm keeping my fingers crossed that we get to take a peek at that.
Another one we'll be playing probably at Origins, then?
Yeah, we'll find out now. Mm-hmm. Anything else cooking?
Nah.
Me either. Nah. Shall we move on to the news?
I say we move on to the news.
Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. North and South America, and all the ships and clippers at sea. Let's go to press flash.
Baldur's Gate, which is this is going to be a gaming-related news piece.
I was
going to
say Baldur's Gate. We're talking old PC game.
Uh-huh. It's the video game series that my son Brian has described as one of the greatest of all time.
He's right.
Is being enhanced and re-released as part of an agreement between Wizards of the Coast, Atari, and Overhaul Games. Overhaul Games has put together a team of artists, designers, and programmers to enhance this classic series. They'll be including some of the original developers in order to remain true to the spirit of the original games. And Overhaul Games actually has many of the original BioWare staff on its rosters.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Baldur's Gate, the Enhanced Edition, and Baldur's Gate 2, the Enhanced Edition, will feature a reforged version of the Infinity Engine with a variety of modern improvements. The original Baldur's Gate was developed by BioWare and released by Interplay Entertainment in 1998.
I remember it very fondly.
I do too, actually. The game has been credited with bringing computerized role-playing games into the spotlight again with its Infinity Engine, which was developed by BioWare. Baldur's Gate uses the second edition AD&D rule system and is set in the Forgotten Realms. The story follows the journey of the player character along the Sword Coast, which lies on the west coast of the continent Faerun, as he or she grows up following the cataclysmic time of troubles. That was very troublesome that time.
Yes, it sure was.
Character development occurs through dialogue and battle, and the game rewards the player character according to his or her moral choices.
Yes.
The original game sold over 2 million copies worldwide and led to many sequels and spin-offs. The one that I remember most was Planescape Torment.
I knew that was coming, yes.
I had a really good time playing that. I can't remember if I ever finished it or not. I know I got really far, but those are games that seem to go on for a long time.
They did. You had 100, 150 hours of gameplay in those easily.
Exactly. And that was the first game that I ever played that allows you to level up,
mm-hmm.
aside from Diablo, of course. And eventually the Infinity Engine led to the classic Neverwinter Nights,
right.
of which we still own 5 copies, actually.
You personally, your family owns.
Yes, yes, we did, because yes. you had to buy one for everybody who played it.
It's funny that you mentioned the Planescape Torment, because it was really well reviewed, but I don't believe it was anywhere near as popular as Baldur's Gate.
No, I don't think it was either. That's just where I got pulled into that whole series, because they also have the Icewind Dale trilogy
yes.
in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of games based on that Infinity Engine. There's no real information out about when a release could be expected yet. Actually, they just opened up baldursgate.com a couple of weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
and on the 15th, they released that there's going to be a whole new enhanced edition of the games coming out.
Okay.
It's funny, I texted Brian and told him, hey, did you hear? And this was on the 17th. The news came out on the 15th. And he said, mm-hmm. oh, yeah, I found this out 2 days ago.
They called me to tell me.
My cousin Daniel texted me and told me about it. Like, oh, geez.
Did you know, on a similar note, remember the game Wasteland?
Oh, yeah. How could I forget Wasteland?
They're looking to do an upgrade to that as well. And I believe that is a project that's currently on Kickstarter.
Really?
Yes.
That was one of those text-based games.
No, that was another role-playing game along the lines of like Baldur's Gate, but it was post-nuclear holocaust. But if I remember right off the top of my head, I can't tell you exactly. But for some reason, I think Wasteland was along the lines of The Bard's Tale. Remember those?
Okay, yeah.
That's going way back. That's for Baldur's Gate and things like that. But that would be cool to see a new updated version of Baldur's Gate. I played through it.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. It was epic. So yes, it was very, very good. Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting news piece.
Actually, Wasteland, now that you mention it, you know, that's the game that led to Fallout.
Yes, I know.
Which is now very popular again today.
That's right. Pre-registration for Huzzah 2012 is now open. Huzzah has become one of New England's premier historical miniature wargaming conventions, and the 2012 edition is being held the weekend of May 4th, 5th, and 6th. With over 70 games and tournaments scheduled for the weekend, the time to act is now. You want to visit the registration site to sign up for the games you want to play before they all fill up. Huzzah 2012 will return to the same location in Portland, Maine, although they've changed the name of the facility. The main ballroom will host most of the games and vendors, although they'll spread out throughout the first floor. The Fireside Inn and Suites Portland is where the convention will take place, and they offer comfortable accommodations, indoor and outdoor pools, sauna, and a fitness center. Discounted room rates are available for Huzzah 2012 Huzzah! Attendees. Huzzah! It's going to offer a terrific weekend of gaming, so you want to join them if you're in the New England area and support the historical wargaming industry. You can bring new people into the hobby, visit with old friends, and make new ones. So join them for Huzzah, Huzzah! 2012. Do you know where Huzzah kind of comes from, at least from what my understanding is?
I don't know.
During the Civil War, of course, the Confederates had the Rebel Yell,
right?
Which is supposed to be just the most insane thing you've ever heard, at least according to author Shelby Foote. The Union troops, on the other hand, had this manly sort of heroic, Huzzah! Huzzah! And that's where I think they get the name for their convention. Although I could be wrong.
No clue.
Not me either. I'm just tossing that out there.
I didn't know that was... I actually thought that went all the way back to England, but I guess not.
That is possible. I don't know. I'm just saying that I think that's where they're using it from.
Yeah, oh, yeah. That makes sense. The first expansion to Sentinels of the Merlin World.
I'm not familiar with that game. Hopefully it's better than Sentinels of the Multiverse.
That's it, Sentinels of the Multiverse, titled Rook City, has shipped to their Kickstarter backers and will be available from retailers this coming April. From Greater Than Games' description, Rook City is a gritty urban expansion for Sentinels of the Multiverse, introducing two new edgy heroes, four terrible villains, and two dangerous environments. Not only does Rook City expand the Sentinels of the Multiverse game, it also brings in new mechanics to deepen your gameplay experience. As you're aware, Sentinels of the Multiverse...
Me?
Yes, you. Sentinels of the Multiverse is a cooperative card game in which 3 to 5 players control a team of superpowered heroes battling a dastardly villain.
Mm-hmm.
It provides players with an innovative, streamlined gameplay experience. Now, these are their words.
Yes, of course, it's their words.
That is easy to learn, but requires strategic, team-based thinking.
Okay.
And actually, we'll have a review of the expansion soon, where we will get a chance to see if some of the problems that you pointed out in the original game have been addressed.
Let's be very honest here. I don't think I'm seeing the expansion. I believe you're going to see right. the expansion.
Yeah, I got a copy.
Yes, I knew they weren't sending me one. Although the thing is, I don't recall giving it a hugely terrible review.
No.
But there were some issues that I had. And then one of them was a combination of villain and environment. And you know how they have the cards that give them their abilities and stuff?
Yes.
That actually created an environment that you couldn't break and you couldn't beat it. So it was an automatic loss because it tied your hands. You couldn't perform actions. You couldn't do this. You couldn't do that. And it was, to me, that it was a big broken piece of the design that could take place.
You inexorably watched your death coming.
Right, with nothing you could do about it. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully they did address that and maybe they fixed that. Maybe they've included new cards as a replacement or something like that. I don't know. All I can go with is my original play of the game for review.
Well, we will find out soon.
Very cool. Speaking of superheroes, Margaret Weiss Productions announces a supplement to their upcoming Marvel heroic role-playing Civil War 50 States Initiative. train your superheroes for this exciting Marvel Civil War-based campaign. The Superhuman Registration Act's ultimate expression of enforcement is the Initiative, a coast-to-coast operation that sets up superhero teams in each of the states of the Union. Train your heroes at Camp Hammond and set up operations in preparation for the next threat to law and order. It includes a full roster of Initiative members and new trainees ready to drop into your Civil War campaign. The Marvel Heroic RPG Civil War Supplement should be in stores this May. I think the Marvel Heroic role-playing game that's just recently come out, I think it's finally arriving in stores. I know it was delayed a bit. I do have a digital copy that I've been taking a peek at for a review. I think it's very cool that they're incorporating the different big events from Marvel recently into the game itself. Actually, you don't normally see that in the comic book role-playing games, at least the ones from the past. So I think that's pretty cool that they're doing that. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I should have a review for the Marvel Heroic role-playing game sometime in the next month.
I wonder, do you have to choose a side as the player character?
In the Civil War expansion, it seems to me as if you're part of the Initiative. So you're on Iron Man's side, which of course at that point in time when Civil War hit, I was a comic book collector, right. And I have to say I was on Captain America's side.
I agree. Come on, it was Captain America.
I mean, come on.
He's got to know best.
That was a very good series.
It was. Although there were like 10 billion copies of the...
That's what I was going to say. I think there was a little too much of the crossover into every issue. And that's not unusual to see with comic book companies. Although I have seen that they're kind of pulling back a little bit on that because it got to the point where people are like, please, I really need to pick up this issue of Black Panther, which I never get anyway because there's a Civil War storyline through it
right. That
had really no importance to the overall story.
No.
That was an issue I had with that. But then again, that's with most of the big crossover events.
Well, I guess that's why they're crossovers.
Yeah. Although, like I said, I'm seeing that DC and Marvel are trimming those back a little bit where it's not every month you're picking up 40 issues of their different comics.
Right.
When in reality, you could probably pick up 3 and get the whole story anyway.
Speaking of Marvel superheroes, here's something that has nothing to do with that at all. The Eclipse board game reprint.
I just thought it was funny how you mentioned that, Sentinels of the Multiverse, and the next news piece I had was the Marvel superheroes.
Well, I was trying to come up with a segue. I can't come up with one at all.
Now that we're done talking about superheroes, that reminds me of...
Here we go. And now for something completely different. The Eclipse board game reprint is coming soon. From various sources, it appears that the reprint of Eclipse will be arriving somewhere between April and June, although that's the closest I can pin it down. Eclipse sold out initially before it even hit the store shelves last year.
My goodness, really?
Yeah, actually it did.
Kane bought them all just so you could have them all.
Rosebud! If you're wondering what the hubbub is about Eclipse, it's a space civilization building game where players are in charge of races from a distant and peaceful galaxy. Actually, peaceful may not be entirely accurate. Because once you open the box with its heavy cardboard, wooden blocks, and plastic ships and start playing the game...
What did I say? Heavy cardboard, wooden blocks?
Do I have to say the comma? Heavy cardboard.
No, just the way you said it. Heavy. Yeah, but you said heavy cardboard wooden blocks. I'm like, so are they wooden or are they cardboard? Did I have to say the comma? Just so you know, the comma usually means it is a slight pause.
Slight pause? All right, I'll emphasize the slight pause. The game features 7 races in all, including humans and 6 alien races. Each race has specific abilities that will guide your strategy as you play. Eclipse demands that you manage 3 different elements. Science will let you purchase more technology. Material will be used to buy ships and outposts, and loans will allow you to run your business without going dead broke.
Aha! Uh-huh.
With science, you can buy technology that will improve your starships by giving them antimatter cannons, for example.
Hopefully it doesn't blind you, though.
The ship blinded me with science!
You knew that!
Or if you can use it to change some of the rules of the game by colonizing the most advanced planets. Eclipse offers many different options for earning victory points. giving you plenty of choices for your developing strategy as opportunities arise. With all these choices, you'll have to keep an eye on your opponents. They could surprise you if you're not careful. The game's played over 9 rounds, during which you'll earn victory points for fighting battles, launching diplomatic missions, conquering space, conducting research, and building monoliths right out of 2001, A Space Odyssey.
You don't have the Star Child, though, do you?
I have one in a jar over here. I keep just for fun.
You got it from Stanley Kubrick. He gave that to you.
Every once in a while, I'll rotate it around, pretending it's spinning.
Just to wake it up.
You'll have plenty of chances to grab the win, but so will your opponents. If you're a fan of Civilization games or Infinite Space, and who's not a fan of Infinite Space?
That's right.
Eclipse should be on your radar. It has an MSRP of $99. But if you're interested, you might want to
pre-order
now.
It's the heavy cardboard blocks.
Right. Why don't we make the wooden blocks into cardboard? Yes, yes, I like that. No cardboard blocks. Sorry.
Well, we have 3 pieces of info from our friends over at Lock and Load Games. They have their next issue of Line of Fire, now available for pre-order. Nuclear Winter 68 and Operation Cobra are now shipping. In Line of Fire 12, this issue is going to be like no other before it. Not only does it contain the articles and scenarios that you expect, but this issue also includes Raid and Repost, a complete game by Mark H. Walker. That's right, Counters, Map, Rules, the works. This issue also features a lot of content on the recently published Forgotten Heroes Vietnam 2nd Edition, a detailed review of the game. Wonder if it's our review. Nah, doubt it.
Probably
good
not.
Game, though.
Yeah.
It also includes an extensive example of play, an in-depth historical article providing background for many of the scenarios, and an article on the American LARPs, and 3 new scenarios for the game. But that isn't all. There's material and counters for many of their other games, including Vietnam versus China Modulette, a White Star Rising scenario, and a scenario depicting a fight between Nicaraguans and Americans in 1985 during Nicaragua's invasion of America with die-cut counters.
Mm.
Do you recall when Nicaragua invaded America?
Nah.
Me either.
All I remember is the Falkland Islands with the British.
Yeah, and that wasn't the Nicaraguans either.
Well, no, I'm not saying it was, but
no, I know.
The only war from that era I can remember.
No, the only thing I remember in Nicaragua was when the U.S. troops went down there right before Christmas to get
Noriega.
Yeah, Noriega.
Mm-hmm. Manuel.
That's all I remember. Anyway, also a game that's been on our radar for a while, Nuclear Winter 68, is now in-house and shipping.
Oh,
so you don't want to miss your chance to get in on a unique platoon-level game that's set in a alternate universe. The former German territory, transformed into a wasteland by the war-ending nuclear holocaust of 1946, is the setting for this 3-way battle for supremacy. Fight as the resurgent Drietz Reich with their powerful E-100 tanks and reworked Stukas. Assume command of NATO with patent M-60s and Russian T-62s, or lead the mysterious Black Hand, mutant warriors who are masters of beast and machine alike. Also, Operation Cobra's shipping, and it's an expansion to White Star Rising. The game includes Polish, Canadian, French, American, and German counters, and chronicles the Allied breakout from Normandy. For more information about the latest issue of Lock and Load, or Nuclear Winter 68, or Operation Cobra, be sure to go over to lockandloadgame.com.
You know, did you ever wonder if in alternate universes, they have games that simulate stuff that happened here?
No, I never have stopped to think about that.
All right, sorry, too much Big Bang Theory.
Are you throwing out some Rod Serling kind of Twilight Zone-ish? Man, now I won't be able to sleep tonight. Now, thanks a lot. Oh my gosh, are they, oh man, do they like, oh.
Somebody could be role-playing me right now.
They could be.
They'd be pretty bored though.
Yeah.
43 AD, role-playing in Roman Britain. Available now as a downloadable PDF is 43 AD from Zoser Games. 43 AD is a gritty military-style RPG with a slice of dark humor running through it.
Hmm.
Just a slice.
Ancient Rome isn't exactly a place that I would think would have a lot of dark humor.
Oh, but... yeah. Oh, you know what's funny? It's not dark humor. It's dark horror.
Oh, okay. Cool.
We're the Britons.
Hey, watch my centurion do his funny walk. Dark humor.
Britain is a place of fear and death, terrors and torments and humor. And the Iron Age tribes live with these horrors. Celtic priests, the Druids, contain them in lakes and pits and forests. When the legions step onto British soil, they step into a land of ancient horrors of which they as yet know nothing. Life, honor, and warfare amongst the tribes is explained for players and GMs alike. Characters are Roman soldiers, fighting for the emperor in a hostile land against the battle-hardened warriors of the tribes. This is a visible enemy, but beyond, should the game master wish to go there, lay the dark secrets of Britain, the night terrors, the death-bringing spirits of the wild, the night crawlers. The night crawlers?
Face-eaters. I guess you go fishing.
The face-eaters, the skin-changers, and the rest of the monsters and wild things that infest Britain. Using fast and gory rules from the tried and tested web game Zenobia, 4380 powers along at a pace. All rolls are made on a D6, with the exception of a D100 being used in character creation. The PDF includes 9 maps of Roman Britain, examples of both play and character creation, 31 adventure seeds, pre-generated squad of Roman soldiers, a complete list of useful NPCs, the GM guide, fully mapped starting locations, spells, monsters, cultural information on the Romans and the Britons, character write-ups that will fit on a single index card, and 10-minute character creation. And 43AD is available at both DriveThruRPG and RPG Now for $19.99. Sounded interesting.
Interesting. Yeah. Speaking of horror in ancient Rome, there's actually a chaosium, they call them monographs, I believe, and they're not necessarily official chaosium Call Cthulhu products, almost like a side product, but there is one that is ancient Rome, and I believe there's some adventures for it as well. I have read through it. It's pretty cool.
Really? I mean, is it Cthulhu related?
Yeah, it's Cthulhu, but it's Cthulhu in ancient Rome.
Oh, that's pretty sweet.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty nicely done.
Neanderthal Cthulhu.
My gosh, these monographs are actually pretty wild. There's maybe 100 of them or something like that. If you go to the Chaosium website, you can see them. Uh-huh. And they're all different kinds of things. There's so much stuff out there for Call Cthulhu that I was never aware of because it's not officially a Chaosium product that it's almost mind-boggling.
Wow.
It's almost mind-shattering.
Sand loss.
Speaking of horror, Zapocalypse is a survival board game set in a post-apocalyptic wasteland. 2 to 4 players start in a basement / fallout shelter, which can lead to several base locations or even through the tunnels to sewer grates throughout the transformable board. Their survivors are trying to make it day to day in a world torn apart by the walking dead. As in any survival game, one needs food, guns, ammo, and more. I guess in that order.
And more.
Players go out into the wasteland and scavenge for supplies, or perhaps to find a new gun or melee weapon to fend off the next zombie attack. In addition to gathering supplies, each player forms and controls their own squad. Each squad works to fortify the base. However, your walls and barbed wire won't hold the dead for long, and they're getting hungry. I assume the undead, as opposed to the survivors. But then again, maybe everybody's hungry.
I'm hungry too.
Maybe I'll eat you, zombie. Players receive victory points for killing zombies, building defenses, and successfully completing goals. Victory points show who's soldiering on the best in this wasteland. The final tally of points determines the winner. Victory points also act as experience points for leveling up a character. The game combines combat, resource collecting, character development, team play, and strategy toward the goal of surviving in the Zapocalypse. You can learn more at the Zapocalypse Kickstarter page, and as of recording this show, it's right about 200% financed with a whopping 34 days to go.
Wow.
Yes.
Zombies are big, man.
That's right, and people are liking Zapocalypse from what they see.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
I believe you are finally up to speed with the latest The Walking Deads. Am I correct?
I am. I went through a marathon Friday night, got to see the 3 episodes that I had missed, and tonight is actually the season finale.
Yes, I'm a little sad that we won't be seeing The Walking Dead until probably next September, October, after tonight.
Yeah.
Although we do get 16 episodes next season, so that's nice. We'll get 3 more episodes than we did this time. we're recording the show, we, of course, obviously have not seen the finale. What do you think is going to happen, my friend, if I may ask?
It's looking like some people are going to become zombie food.
I'm thinking the same thing. One thing I thought was pretty wild is last week I was working on something, so I didn't get to see The Walking Dead right away. And I figured, oh, well, you know, I'll just wait till Monday and I'll watch it. And all of a sudden I get this call from my brother, and my brother's like, did you watch it tonight? And I said, well, no, not yet. He's like, you got to watch it. You have to watch it. Jeez, you know, I'm in the middle of something here. I probably won't be done for another 2 hours. I don't want to watch it at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. He goes, all I got to say is you got to watch it. And he hangs up. So, of course, I had to watch it. For a minute, that whole showdown between Rick and Shane, I thought it was possible that they were going to throw a huge wrench in the whole works and kill Rick.
You know, I wasn't sure how it was going to go, because they can change whatever they want, you know?
Right, exactly. And there are a lot of things that are different in the show than in the comic. Dale dying this early, that was another one.
I'm guessing that Herschel is going to be toast. That's my first guess.
I think everyone in Herschel's family outside of Maggie is toast. And I think T-Dog is going to buy the farm.
Yes, because he hasn't done really much of anything.
No, which is pretty surprising because there was a character in the comic book, Tyrese, I think was the character's name. He was a huge character in the comic for quite a long time before they whacked him. It's kind of my impression. I think we are going to see the survivors lose a member in T-Dog and gain a member in Maggie. And it is finally Hasta La Vista Farm.
Finally.
Finally.
After more than one whole season there.
Well, no, it was this season. They weren't on the farm last season.
Didn't they end it up last season?
No. Oh, last season ended with the CDC. Shot, right? No, the CDC blew up. The first season was only 6 episodes.
Oh, that's right. I don't remember.
They didn't hit the farm until, I think, episode 3 of this season, something around there. But they spent an awfully long time. And one last thing I wanted to mention about The Walking Dead. I don't know if a lot of other people have noticed this, but before the season began, they were showing this trailer reel that had the song Civilian by Y-Oak. Very cool song. But there were scenes that they showed in the trailer that never made it into this season.
Yeah.
And one of them was Shane with a full head of hair running in the daytime from a bunch of zombies firing off a shotgun. And then the other one, which I thought was a big thing, was it looked like the survivors, Rick and Shane and a few others, were back at that area from the episode Vatos, where the Latino guys were actually protecting the folks in the retirement home.
Yeah.
And it looked like the leader of that group was laying there dead, and Shane yells something like, Rick, don't! And he just says, the hell with it, and he starts shooting. Never happened.
No, that never happened either.
Mm-mm. No, I thought that was very, very unusual.
What do you think about the zombie cow?
That was interesting, just like you've got Shane returning as a zombie.
Right.
Without being bitten. Right. So right there, that's telling you that the virus, or whatever it is not something that necessarily has to be transferred from a zombie to a person, so everyone's infected.
Mm-hmm. It's evolving. It's mutating.
Could be. And that might be what the character at the CDC whispered in Rick's ear at the end of last season.
I thought he whispered that she was pregnant.
That's what I thought was probably the case, but I don't know.
Okay, well, Enough of the Walking Dead podcast.
We're not the Talking Walking Dead or the Talking Dead that's on AMC. My brother catches that after every episode. I've never seen it or listened to it or whatever, but moving right along. The only thing I want to say is, yes, I'm kind of sad that it's the end of this season for The Walking Dead. But my sadness is tempered by the fact that one of my favorite shows, Mad Men, returns a week from Sunday. So a week from today. So I'm excited about that.
Doesn't Game of Thrones start again next month?
I believe April 1st.
Oh, see, there we go. Someday I'll see season.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. I won't ruin it for you. No, thanks. I'm kidding.
I've read the first two books.
Yeah. So, and that really did not stray from the story. That's pretty much true to the book.
Okay. They're just taking a little longer to get around to stuff.
Yes.
Small World Realms has been announced by Days of Wonder. For those looking to expand their Small World, Days of Wonder has announced a new big box expansion compatible with both Small World and Small World Underground called Small World Realms. Medium World. Eventually we'll get to Big World, you know. Small World Realms is a big new expansion that features scores of puzzle-like geomorphic terrain regions that are assembled into variously sized and shaped board maps. Map designs are based on any of the dozen preset scenarios created by the game's designer, Felipe Quiartes. Players can also use the various terrain pieces to build their own custom maps and scenarios, making Realms the definitive world-building toolkit for the Small World and Small World Underground fans alike. The Small World Realms expansion is expected to be available in Better Game stores throughout Europe in June and in North America in early July. The MSRP will be about $35.
And if you don't have a Better Game store nearby, you're out of luck.
That's right. You'll have to go to one of those crappy ones.
And beg them to order it for you. Please, oh lousy game store owner, please order this for me. No, I'm not ordering it for you. That's why it's a crappy game store.
A quick trivia question.
Sure.
What is this from? You wouldn't hit a bat with glasses now, would you?
Dracula dead and loving it? I don't know.
Do you remember the Bugs Bunny cartoon with Dracula where he's walking around going, abracadabra, and he would turn into a bat?
No, okay. I don't remember that.
Never mind then.
No, which is surprising because you know me, I remember stuff about movies I've never even seen. Oh, that movie? Yeah, that stars so-and-so. It's about blah, 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 blah. Oh, well, did you like it? No, I've never seen it. I don't know.
Huh? I was telling Allie about it. I don't know why it occurred to me, but, you know, he would say abracadabra, and Dracula would automatically turn into a bat. So he's holding this big stone above his head, and he goes, abracadabra, and he turns into a bat, and the stone crushes him. And he says, hocus pocus, and turns back into Dracula, and they do it like half a dozen times.
Okay, yeah, now it's starting to come back. Yes, yeah, so it's kind of like dueling. Keeps turning into a bat, and he keeps turning himself back into Dracula, and Bugs keeps turning him into a bat.
So anyway, we eventually found that over on YouTube and watched it, and it was quite hilarious, even 50, 60 years later.
Oh, of course. You know what's interesting? See if you can find some of the cartoons that, especially, there's a lot of Disney shorts that they did during World War II that you will never see ever again, but you can find them online, and some of them are really pretty wild. Like Donald Duck fighting Hitler. Just really amazing stuff. And then, of course, you've got the cartoons that you'll never see anymore because they were very racist.
Racially insensitive, yes. Like early Tom and Jerry cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Japanese as portrayed in many Disney cartoons.
Or even Warner Brothers. Don't let Warner Brothers off the hook.
That is true.
But then again, you know, that was a sign of the times. I don't believe in judging individuals based upon the time we live in now as opposed to the time that they lived. Really. Well, I'll give you a great example real quick. One of my favorite documentaries of all time is Ken Burns' The Civil War. And there's a woman, she's African-American, I'll point out. There's a woman who is one of their experts. And she talks about Lincoln and talks about how he could have done so much more and things like that. And she's kind of knocking him. And I sat there and I thought to myself, well, you know, it's pretty easy in the 1980s to look back and say, well, you know, in the 1860s, this is what the president should have been doing. Guess what? It's not the 1860s. So how can you actually judge them by their time outside of that context?
Exactly.
Which, interestingly, will now lead into a segue into my next news piece.
Oh, man, you're really getting good at this.
I'm just saying, you know, we're talking about kind of like controversy and things like that and racism. And this is a serious bit of news. A Dutch public broadcasting network last month offered its viewers a board game called Settlers of the West Bank. And it featured Israeli settlers who use a, quote, Jewish stinginess card and, quote, the Anne Frank card, end quote, to colonize the West Bank. The network, VPro, removed the game after human rights groups called it anti-Semitic, and they finally pulled it down from their website on Wednesday. The TV network is actually run with funds provided by the Dutch government, and the decision to remove the game followed the publication of an expose in the Jerusalem Post on Tuesday. Terrorist attacks are described as a natural result of settlement expansion. Saw wood and you get wood chips. Not everyone's happy with the Israeli settlements, least of all the terrorists. the instructions explain. Terrorist attacks cost players resources. The settler may also use the Mahmoud Ahmadinejad card to avoid losing resources to a terrorist and simultaneously drawing resources from other players. The Anne Frank House is a winning point for the settler. According to a VPro statement, in November 2010, the VPro platform for younger viewers, Dorst, published on the website and in the TV guide a satirical item, The Settlers of the West Bank, a commentary over the Israeli-Palestinian conflict shaped in the form of a well-known board game, The Settlers of Catan. The Settlers of the West Bank is now, almost 1 year and a half later, the subject of discussion on whether it contains elements of an anti-Semitic nature. VPro finds the political question relevant and will obligingly discuss the borders of satire, but it has no desire or need to discuss alleged anti-Semitism through this item.
Wow.
Do we live in the 21st century or not?
I try to.
Kind of my thought here. You know, I understand the very, very difficult and disturbing realities of the Middle East. We could actually have a show that we talked about stuff that goes on in the Middle East every week.
Coming soon.
Okay, it's satirical. Fine. Just like the War on Terror game. I don't understand why that exists either.
Right.
I don't know. It just, to me, I think as humanity, don't we feel that we should be beyond this?
What direction are you going in?
Me?
Yeah. You think it's bad?
Yes, of course I think it's bad. I think it's horrendous.
I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah. Don't you think it's about time that we were even more anti-Semitic? Don't you think so?
Right, because I could believe that. Come on, the Jewish stinginess card?
Right. Yeah, the Anne Frank card. Yes.
Come on. No, there's. You can make a satirical game without making it racially offensive, I think.
And disgusting. I don't even find that offensive. I find it disgusting. It's repulsive to me.
Would be hard to do nowadays. The Blazing Saddles, the movie.
Right. We've talked about that before. You would never see something like that made in Hollywood today. Wouldn't happen.
No. But he made an effort to make it racially offensive to
everyone.
Everybody.
Right. Exactly.
You know? It's not geared towards anyone in particular. He even had an Irish joke in it.
Everybody was fair game to Mel Brooks in that film. And the reality is the character who is the most sensical and who is not a stereotype type is actually the black sheriff.
Right, exactly.
It's LeVon Little.
Yep. Well, I like to screw, play chess.
Yeah, right.
Well, let's play chess.
Right. Allow me to whip this out.
But yeah, I would think that we should be beyond this point now where we're having games like come out. What, it took them a year and a half to notice it, though?
I guess it was flying under the radar for most people. I had never heard of it.
No, well, me neither. Yeah. Wouldn't somebody have sued them for trying to make us settlers of...
That's the one thing I kind of thought of, too. It was sort of, where were the folks behind Settlers of Catan? No, I'm not trying to stir up any controversy with them.
No, not at all. We'll see where that goes. Well, it's gone now, right? It's been pulled completely?
Yeah, it's been pulled. But, well, you know, what it really tells you is that that mindset that led to the Holocaust, it still exists in people's heads.
Yeah, which is a scary thought.
It is a very scary thought. And our last news items, I just wanted to mention a couple of things regarding ourselves and the gaming gang. Number one, we were the top vote getter in the little contest that was going on for the Kickstarter project Nature of the Beast, Prairie versus Polar. So we were the top vote getter, followed by, yay, the Dice Tower and Tom Vassell. So I guess because we're the winners, both the Dice Tower and ourselves, that we're going to have promotional cards done up that represent the podcasts that are going to be included in, I guess, the pre-release editions of the game for the people who supported the game on Kickstarter. So I thought that was kind of funny. Also, people may have noticed that over the past couple of days, the Look to the Gaming Gang website has changed up quite a lot. I did a redesign of the website. Still a few tweaks being made. Everything is not completely finalized with the website, but hopefully you're going to enjoy the new look, the new functions of the website, as well as some of the new coverage that we're going to provide for some topics that are not specifically gaming related.
Right, like lobster fishing.
Well, that's your forte, not mine. Yeah, I'd know nothing about that. You're the guy who knows all about that.
Right. Yeah, I'm actually wearing my big rubber boots right now.
Okay. It's a little more information than I or anyone else needs to know. In fact, Jeff, that's all I'm wearing right now.
And a big raincoat.
There you go. Getting prepared. Actually, talking about rain, it's raining right here in the Phoenix Valley.
Really? Which, you know, it's been 80 degrees here this week.
Yeah, I heard it's been very nice. I heard this winter wasn't very bad.
Nope, not at all.
Now, I leave Chicago and the winters are not as brutal as they were when I lived there. I see how that works.
Uh-huh.
And the last thing that I did want to mention is there are going to be quite a few conventions that we will be providing coverage of this year. Coming up, we've got, just off the top of my head, of course, obviously, Elliot and I will be at Origins and Gen Con again.
Yes.
I will be at ConSim World Expo. That's here in Tempe, Arizona. Elliot is going to be covering the C2E2 in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to cover the Phoenix Comic Con, I believe, hopefully with my brother. And we are probably, at this point, we're not sure yet, but we are also probably going to be covering the San Diego Comic Con.
Wouldn't that be cool?
That should be very cool.
A lot closer to you than me, though.
Well, it's still not in my backyard, but it's a huge event. So getting in there as members of the media is going to be a pretty big deal. We'll know more about that probably sometime in mid-April, mm-hmm. if we're going to be covering that or not. So, and of course, if there's other smaller shows that are in the area, Illinois or in Arizona, I pretty much know what's in Arizona. I don't know what's in Illinois. Let us know. And if we're able to make it out to the event to provide some coverage, we'd be more than happy to do so.
That's right.
All right. So shall we move on to the reviews?
Sounds like a plan to me.
And now it's time for the Gaming Gang's game review. Try saying that 10 times fast.
I'm not going to try. I'm going to get the reviews rolling along with Mundus Novus, designed by Bruno Catharla and Serge Leger. It's published by Asmodee Editions, released in 2011. It's a game for 2 to 6 players, and it plays in 45 minutes or less or more. And the suggested ages are 14 and up. The idea behind Mundus Novus is that players are wealthy merchants sailing to the newly discovered Americas in order to make their fortunes. Mundus Novus is Latin for New World. What's this, Jeff, you may ask? You're reviewing a game of 16th century trading. You know that same theme you make fun of? Well, I only made fun of it once.
Right.
And yes, I am. Sure, this theme has seen more use than Lindsay Lohan on a Saturday night. But in a lot of ways, I'm glad I gave Mundus Novus a go. On a side note, just to set the record straight, I have never had a go at Lindsay Lohan. The seeds of this game actually lay in designer Leger's 2003 release, Mare Nostrum. But much of what makes Mare Nostrum an epic 2-plus hour game has been stripped away. This leaves behind a much faster playing experience, but at the cost of depth and much of what makes the 2003 game popular. I'm going to say right off the bat, if you're a big fan of Mare Nostrum, you might not have much interest in Mundus Novus. But if you don't own the previous game, this new design just may be up your alley. The components are nice, and you receive 1 start player token, 6 event reminder chits, 44 development cards, 90 doubloon chits, which represent victory points, and 120 resource cards. The cards look especially sharp and are very nice quality with wonderful artwork. There are also rule books in 5 languages, so all the bases are covered there, and the English rules mostly make sense outside of the glaring omission of what constitutes a combination of cards. I'll point out also there are no player aids included in the game. And although maybe after a few plays you really wouldn't need one, there really should be a set of aids to help players get started and to help someone you might like to teach the game in the future. The lack of player aids really came as a surprise, as there's various charts you have to consult to determine how resources are traded in for developments and or victory points. Passing the rulebook around was a real drag and leads to an inflated playtime. The goal of Mundus Novus is pretty simple. You can either have all 10 of the different resource cards at one time, collect 75 doubloons, or have the most money when the development deck runs out. The goals sound easy enough, but achieving them is an entirely different matter. Each player receives 5 cards each turn and discards any unused cards at the end of the turn. So collecting those 10 resources in a pop is a lot harder than you might think. Many times the dough you've earned turns out to be the deciding factor in winning. You begin setup by shuffling the resource cards and draw three cards, which will make up the market, while placing the rest face down in the middle of the table. Then the development cards are shuffled, and the top five are placed in a row to form a queue of cards, 1 through 5. The youngest player becomes the trade master, and a no event marker is placed on the first face-up development card as a reminder that no events take place in the first round. Then you're ready to play. Gameplay breaks down into rounds, within which is further broken down into 4 phases, and continues until someone achieves one of the victory conditions. The 4 phases play out as such. The event phase. An event is determined that will affect the rest of the round based on the icon on the first development card in queue. As examples, a fire will make any warehouses owned by the players completely unusable that round, or a King's Aid event allows for more than one combination of resources to be spent on developments in the progression phase. Supply. Everyone is dealt a hand of 5 cards. Then one resource card is dealt face up in the center of the table for each development caravel the players currently possess. Anyone with caravels can then draft these cards to add to their hand based in order of the highest fleet values. Each caravel, which is a ship, has a point value, and this is combined to get your fleet score. This is a seafaring trading game, so you need ships, baby, and the bigger the better. Trade. The trade master, or what we would consider the starting player, picks a number from 2 to 4, and players secretly choose that number of cards from their hand they're willing to trade. These cards are then simultaneously revealed and placed in front of each of the players. The person who's willing to trade the highest combined value of cards is now immediately declared the new trade master. The resource cards are all ranked in value from 1 through 9. This new trade master selects one resource being offered in trade, and then the player that has just had their card chosen proceeds to choose a card from someone else. This continues until there are either no cards left to choose, or the last player with the ability to select a card decides not to. No more than 2 consecutive trades between the same players can take place, so everyone should get a shot. It's important to keep in mind a player only gets to select a resource card if someone has taken one of theirs. Any unclaimed resource cards are returned to the owning player's hand. Trading really is the heart of Mundus Novus. Then you have the progression phase. The trade master chooses a player, and that player must spend all of their resource cards and discard any that they do not spend. There are a few things you can do with these resource cards. You can spend a combination of identical resources to take a development card. This is where the confusion of what constitutes a set came up, as there's no indication anywhere that I could find in the rules that said how many matching cards are needed. After searching around online, I finally found out that a combination to create a set for this purpose is 3 cards. I know some people out there would say, well, yeah, it's a set collecting game. Usually it's 3 of a kind. Yes, but I didn't want to go with just, well, it's usually this. It should be in the rules.
Right.
Ink and relics can be used as wild cards as well. And depending on the value of the resources, you're able to choose the first development card in queue, or the first 3, or any of those 5. So the higher value of that collected set gives you an option. You can only acquire 1 development unless the King's Aid event is in play, which allows you to buy 2. You can also spend 1 combination of different resources to earn doubloons. Here you may combine more than 3 cards in order to score victory points, and then the number of cards determine the payout. You can spend an ink and relic resource and get more doubloons. There are a variety of development cards available, and all of them provide some sort of a benefit. Caravels allow you the exclusive rights to those additional resources each round. Warehouses allow you to store a resource until the next turn. Explorers can radically change abilities or earning potential, and so on. That is, as they say, that as far as playing the game. I'll also say that Mundus Novus is one of the better Euros I've played recently, but that may come across as faint praise. You never know who's going to win until one of those victory conditions are met. So you could be cruising along, amassing a vast empire of developments and wealth, only to have an opponent whip out that perfect combination of 10 cards and automatically win the game. There are a couple of different strategies you can take on, such as trying to win through having the most doubloons or aiming to achieve that perfect 10-card combo. The field is evened a bit with all the players because normally you can only trade in 1 combination for a development and 1 combination for doubloons. But the choice of options certainly starts to break down and feel limited. And there is the problem I see with Mundus Novus. It's a fun play the first couple of times, but repeated play shows you that the game just always feels the same. You're making the same decisions every round of every game. The meat of the game, the trading phase, doesn't seem as if it's all that much of an important impact when you compare it to how much time it takes throughout the entire gameplay. So much time is developed to that trading phase, you'd think it would play out to be more important in the game than it really does. The different development cards do add a nice wrinkle, and they have some variety, but simply not enough to make Mundus Novus a game to play again and again. I'm not saying Mundus Novus is a bad game by any stretch, so I'm giving it a recommendation, albeit just not a very enthusiastic one.
Hey, but it's a Euro game. You're actually recommending a Euro game.
Yes, Luke, come over to the dark side.
I'm so glad you enjoyed my Euro game.
Like I said before, I like good Euro games. This isn't a bad game, and it is a lot of fun the first few times that you'll play it, but it's certainly one of those games where the luster is going to just really fall off on your third, your fourth, maybe your fifth time you play. So this isn't going to be something where your usual group of friends that you game with regularly, you get together and everybody goes, hey, man, bust out Mundus Novus. Woo. Gotta get a game into that.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the player aid thing.
Yes.
I really agree that just having any kind of player aid in the games is a huge help. And I see it in a lot of games, but there's a lot of games where you don't see them at all. And sometimes they'll just put like little charts on the back of the rule book.
Right.
Well,
exactly.
At that point, you're still all passing the rule book around, and it's a big pain in the butt. Just one little card that sums up the most important stuff that you don't want anybody to forget or that comes in handy that you can hand out to each player are a huge help teaching the game.
Oh, most definitely. And I don't want to belabor the point that it seems that a lot of the Euros that I'm exposed to have rule issues. This combination thing, that's a big deal. That's how you get the developments. And the developments are cool because as you get these developments, they're giving you these extra abilities. So you're able to get more cards to maybe get those 10 cards through the trading and to get the doubloons and be able to have merchants and explorers and all of these things. And to leave that fundamental one aspect explaining what is a combination out of the rules, it's practically unforgivable.
Unforgiven. I know what you're talking about because having to go search around to figure something out is a pain in the butt.
Right. Something as simple as that. The rules aren't horrible. They're fine. Really, the only thing that I had any issue trying to figure out is what constituted a combination to buy the developments.
Right.
You know, it's an all right game. I'd say the score it's going to get when I provide the written review is right about 6, 5, 7, right in that vicinity.
That's not bad at all.
No, not a bad game.
Well, my first review, speaking of Euro games, is going to be Giza, the Great Pyramid.
Dun, 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 dun.
From Mayfair Games. That was designed by David Haraber, and it came out just recently in 2012. It's for 3 or 4 players. You know, your 1-player, 2-player games, you're not going to be having that. That's a little bit of a tough sell there. But the game itself, well, I have to say I am starting to understand the Euro games more. As I am American, I do have a penchant for American-style games.
I'm a little surprised you've had an issue with understanding the Euro games, or is it just the Euro game mindset that
Okay. Probably a better way to say it. Yes, the Euro.
Yeah, because I was going to say, as far as I understand, you understand the games just fine.
Oh, yeah. I find that Ameritheme games, and I'm purposely using Ameritheme, concentrate on fun, excitement, and theme.
And rolling them bones.
Roll the bones. And Euro games seem to concentrate more on strategy, puzzles, and development. Now, that's just a very broad generalization. There's plenty of strategic American games and fun.
I was going to say, yeah, I don't agree with the strategy.
Right, because there's lots of war games, a whole genre that are all strategy.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
But so don't accuse me of slapping a label on both gaming cultures.
You're a labeler.
I just feel that I'm coming to appreciate the unique qualities of both types of games more. So this leads me to Giza. Would I classify it as fun or exciting? No. Not really.
It isn't, but you understood it.
But I understand it. It isn't a game that you sit down with the guys, grab a beer, and have a few laughs. This is a game that you plan out. You keep an eye on what the competition is doing. You think about your moves, and you build a neat little plastic pyramid. The theme is what drew me in initially. I am an Egyptology buff, and this made Giza a natural pick for me to try. The theme does hold up in Giza, as opposed to many Euros I've tried. I never felt that I could simply paste any theme on Giza and it would still work.
You're building a starship.
Pyramid shape. I'm getting ahead of myself, though. The components are standard. The tokens, wooden blocks, a game board, and some player screens make up the bulk of the game and convey the Egyptian theme very well. There's no pesky text to translate into other languages either. All the text is in the rules, excepting the hieroglyphics, of course. The pyramid is plastic and it's in 9 little separate parts. The whole goal of the game is to assemble the pyramid on the board, piece by laborious piece, gathering victory points as you go. The game ends when the pyramid is assembled, or after 10 rounds, whichever comes first. In Giza, you will send your workers to gather food, pray at the Temple of Ra, create artwork, drag the pyramid pieces to the site, and and lift the pieces into place on the pyramid. That's really all there is to it. There's no randomness, there's no dice rolls, and there's no event cards. If you win, it will be because you were able to outthink your opponents.
Nice.
Each player selects a color and takes all of the wooden blocks of that color. They also receive some starting food and artwork. Since bidding is the main player interaction component to the game, each player will also receive a player screen to keep all of their pieces behind, so that the other players don't know how much of everything they all have.
Mm-hmm.
Players will place a block on the scoring track, 5 blocks next to the turn order section of the board, and the rest are placed block by block in turn around the different board locations. The first turn is the only one where player order is not calculated by the players themselves. You choose a starting player at random, and that player places their first turn block on the turn order board. Players then take turns clockwise, placing their own block on the turn section around the table.
Around the clock to place your block.
The turn order board has 5 lines with 8 spaces on each line. Depending on which bonus you would like to receive and how soon you would like to take your turn, you pick a spot on the first line to place your block. And it's red from top to bottom. The player nearest the top will go first, and the player nearest the bottom will go last. However, you can only select a line once during each dynasty, which is 5 turns. After the 5th turn, the blocks are removed and the second dynasty begins. Then, at the end of the second dynasty, the game's over. After the first turn, players place their blocks in reverse order on the turn section, and this pattern continues throughout the game. During your turn, you'll get 3 actions. You can choose to farm or fish, which gains you a certain number of food tokens. You can create artwork, which gives you art tokens. You can move a worker from one location to another, or chase a moving sled down one of the quarry tracks. There are 4 quarry tracks, 3 in a 3-player game, and each one has a sled token on it. On each of these sleds...
Is it called Rosebud?
Rosebud. How many times we can get that in?
I was going to say, it's funny we're mentioning this because a good friend of mine, she had never seen Citizen Kane. And I was like, what? Seriously? She's like, no, I never saw it. So I made sure that I got her a copy of Citizen Kane.
There you go. I'm guessing that probably most of my children have never seen Citizen Kane.
Well, she's 36. I'm not hanging out with your children.
No, that'd be a long-distance hangout.
But she's the kind of individual who would want to see Citizen Kane.
To see something like that, right.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, go ahead.
It's cool. You want to get your workers onto these sleds in order to move them along the quarry tracks to the pyramid site. Each sled can hold up to 4 workers of any color, and it takes at least 3 to get the sled to move at all. After you take your 3 actions, you may either select a sled that you wish to move or select a piece already at the site that you wish to lift up onto the pyramid. There's 2 lift camps, one for the middle tier of the pyramid and one for the capstone. The base pieces are dragged directly to the site and placed. The middle tier must be dragged to the middle lift camp and then lifted onto the pyramid. The capstone must be dragged to the site, lifted from the middle lift camp to the capstone lift camp, and then lifted from there to the top of the pyramid. The game will end when the capstone is placed, if it happens before the end of the 10th round. If you choose to move a sled, each player with workers on that sled bids food tokens. You can bid from 0 to 2 food per worker that you have on that sled. And as each sled can hold up to 4 workers, if at least 4 food tokens are not bid, then the sled does not move, and the player who bid the least amount must remove a worker from the sled, because they're starving.
Yeah.
See? The more that is bid, the farther the sled moves along the track to the pyramid site. Once a sled reaches a site, the player moves a pyramid piece either to the site or to the middle lift camp, depending on what piece it actually is. Players score victory points based on the number of workers that they had on the sled. If you complete a row on the pyramid, you then bid artwork to decorate it.
Mm-hmm.
The player who bids the most artwork scores the most victory points for decorating. Now, if you complete an entire tier, then workers praying in the Temple of Ra earn those players additional victory points. If you choose to lift a stone, each player bids food from 0 to 2 per worker to lift the stone onto the pyramid. A total of 4 food must be bid or that lift fails, and a worker again starves and is moved to the farming location. Play then passes to the next player on the track, and this continues until the game end. The player with the most victory points at the end of the game wins. I found it very interesting and a challenge to come up with the right combination of strategies to maximize your victory points. It is possible to force other workers off of your sled by starving them off. Which is kind of cool. If you deliver a...
Which is cool.
Oh, he's dead. And if you
oh,
have
you can
one
do
of your
that.
Workers... You can have one of your workers run up behind it and jump on once you starve one of the other guys off.
Mm-hmm.
If you deliver a sled with only your workers on it, you get a 4-point bonus. You need a lot of food, but it won't help if you lose all of the artwork victory points. The whole game is moving and scoring, and I found it challenging, but not complicated. It was like a puzzle with the added challenge of other players to deal with.
Right. A lot of juggling going on.
Mm-hmm. I liked it. I was not as bored as I tend to feel during many Euro games I've played.
Right.
The kids themselves, they were kind of indifferent, but when I played with competitive players, they did get into it and we had a good time. As I said, it's well-themed, it's easy to learn, the rules have many examples, and were fairly short and simple. I think players who like the Egypt theme, or puzzles, or games that take some contemplation, will enjoy playing Giza.
The whole pyramid building theme, that's another one that's seen about as much action as Madonna.
We're on to Madonna now.
Well, I'm just tossing out women with loose morals, I suppose.
Which is our next podcast.
That's right. That's one of the new topics of discussion on the website. Non-gaming related. So it is nice to hear you talking about a game that breaks out of that mold a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, it really is cool. You're putting the workers on this one of those big sled tokens, and you just picture them dragging this thing over to the pyramid site.
And I know you being the component junkie, the fact that you're getting to build a little pyramid added to the appeal as well.
It's true.
Yeah.
And it did stick together fairly well. The pieces kind of interlock.
Mm-hmm.
They're just little plastic pieces, but they
fit
together pretty good, and the thing would hold up. When you pick it up, it wouldn't just all fall into 9 pieces again.
You know, on a side note, do you realize that there's a lot of discussion now that many of the pyramids weren't actually built by slaves, that they were actually paid workers?
I actually have heard that because they found some sites near the pyramid sites where people lived in communities and were not slavey type people. They're actually kept.
Slavey type? I'm slavey not really type. Sure what it is. Slavey type guy.
They all lived together. The overseers lived there in the same camps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, which would be kind of a nice thing to think. Of course, these are the ancient Egyptians.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're talking about ancient history, too. So you can never be too sure about anything, as well as slavery existed for thousands of years. So the fact that the pharaohs would have used slave labor wouldn't be any great shock.
Yeah, that's true. It's more of a shock that they weren't, really.
Exactly. That's why I thought I'd mention that, because I've heard some discussion about that recently over the past few years, that it's possible they really weren't slaves.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. You don't have to work today. You can stay home.
Of course.
You weren't really planning on eating, though.
Just drink your beer.
Green beer for St. Patty's Day.
I watched a documentary called, I want to say it was called How Beer Saved the World or something along those lines. It's on Netflix. And they talk about medieval history, ancient history, because if I remember correctly, it's the Egyptians who created beer. And one of the reasons why they've talked about how it's very possible that the workers who built the pyramids were not slaves is because they found out that each of them had a beer ration that they received every day, which was like 2 gallons.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Nobody wanted to drink water throughout most of history because of all the bacteria and you'd get sick. That's why everybody drank beer, even in revolutionary era America.
Ah, yes. Those days were more fun. You could just get up, the kids all sit down and have a nice pint together.
If they lived that long.
Right. If they didn't all get smallpox.
Yeah. What's your name again? I forget. I'm not going to get attached to you until you're about six.
Child 4 is sick.
Yes. Unfortunately, that was the reality of things.
That's true.
My final review is going to be Franco-Prussian War 40, released by Victory Point Games, designed by Joe Miranda. It is for 2 players. It just recently came out as well, and the suggested ages is 12 and up. Vom Krieg is a book on war and military strategy by Prussian General Karl von Clausewitz, written mostly after the Napoleonic Wars between 1816 and 1830, and published posthumously by his wife in 1832. Been translated into English several times as On War. On War is actually an unfinished work. Clausewitz had set about revising his accumulated manuscripts in 1827, but didn't live long enough to finish the task. His wife, with whom he shared a deep intellectual relationship, actually edited his collected works and published them between 1832 and 1835. On War is formed by the first 3 volumes and represents his theoretical explorations. It's one of the most important books ever written on political military analysis and strategy, and remains both controversial and a living influence on strategic thinking. Clausewitz was among those intrigued by the manner in which the leaders of the French Revolution, especially Napoleon, had changed the conduct of war through their ability to motivate the populace and gain access to the full resources of the state, thus unleashing war on a greater scale than had ever been seen previously in Europe. Clausewitz was well-educated and had a strong interest in art, history, science, and education. He was a professional soldier who spent a considerable part of his life fighting against Napoleon. The insights he gained from his political and military experiences, combined with the solid grasp of European history to that point, provided the basis for the book. Von Clausewitz's book and theoretical thinking on war are also the basis for this new series bearing the general's name, just launched by our friends at Victory Point Games. The first title in the line, designed by venerable war game designer Joe Miranda, is Franco-Prussian War 40. As with some of the VPG war games, the number in the title refers to the number of playing pieces on the board. 40 counters on a game board is certainly child's play for many established gamers out there, and that should give an indication that FP40, as I'm going to call it, is an intermediate level game. Upon first looking at the contents of the game package, you may have the impression this is just a throwback to the rather uncomplicated war games of the past. The map is rather small and, truth be told, a bit on the bland side. The counters simply show the type of force, army, corps, division, brigade, or fortress, and the strength and movement rates. The combat resolution chart is based on combat differential of attacker strength minus defender strength. All in all, it's looking like it's going to be an unremarkable game. But then again, this is Victory Point Games, so you know there's something going to be up their sleeves. And by this, I mean the rules and what's a mainstay of many VPG titles, event cards. A few of von Clausewitz's key concepts are tackled in the game design, and these are fog of war, friction, and war as a political instrument. Fog of war probably needs no explanation outside the fact it's really never knowing exactly what you might be going up against at any given moment until you engage the enemy. Friction is the thinking that the more an overall commander tries to accomplish and the grander the battle plan, the more likely things will go wrong, sometimes horribly so. Juarez politic is a bit harder for the average person on the street to fathom, but it was von Clausewitz's view that war was never a means unto itself. Or to quote him, war is not merely a political act, but also a real political instrument, a continuation of political commerce, a carrying out of the same by other means. Simply enough, we've seen the fog of war in all sorts of forms and designs from way back. Friction is modeled in a multitude of ways in other games, in which one player can only do so much before the opponent can jump in and begin their operations. GMT's Fighting Formations jumps immediately to mind as a recent example, although the design concept isn't usually referred to as friction to my knowledge. And national morale has been included in a multitude of games that tackle a larger, higher-level, epic strategic viewpoint. Fact is, although none of these concepts are anything truly new to an experienced wargamer, Mr. Miranda has combined these nicely into a fast-playing title that can be tossed into your briefcase, whipped out, and set up in no time. For the sake of brevity, and I'll go into more detail in the written review, I'm not going to tackle all the phases for each player turn, but provide more of an overall look at how the mechanics play together as a whole. Obviously enough, one player will command the French, while the other leads the Prussian forces. It was the French, interestingly enough, who declared war on Prussia, although the other German states quickly jumped in on the Prussian side, yet it was in France that a great bulk of the action took place. Each turn, one player will draw an event card. More can be gained by acquiring friction, which is bad, and spending morale, which is also not good, and begin to place reinforcement units through mobilization. Next, that player may move units, and once he's completed movement, his opponent then has an opportunity to move any units that are eligible for reactionary movement. Then combat is conducted, followed by an administrative, or I guess we would say cleanup phase, where, among other things, another event card is drawn. Each player does have a limit to the number of cards that they have in their hand at any one time. In the beginning, the French can have 3 and the German Confederation 4. Then it's on to the second player, who repeats the process. The standard game consists of 12 turns, and there's an extended option for 16 turns. The war, in reality, was only 11 months in length. To this point, it sounds like FP40 is just old hat, but there's a bit more cooking to the design that helps it shine. While one player is going about their turn, their opponent can spend friction points that the active player is accumulating to make life more difficult on that active player. These can be things like imposing a penalty to a stack of moving forces, making it more difficult to get them where they need to be, adding a negative modifier to combat for the attacker, preventing that free event card draw in the administration phase, and more. Then you have the ever-present VPG event cards. Each player begins with a specific set of cards from their respective deck to begin the game. But once the action is underway, you'll never know what your opponent has in hand unless you spend friction points in order to see those. Many of the cards have a variety of options depending on what turn phases are listed on the card. Cards can only be played in a phase of the turn that appears in print. For an example, a particular card might be playable only in the mobilization phase, during combat, or in a siege, and may provide radically different benefits depending on when it's played. The event cards also provide a very nice narrative to the war itself and historical flavor, especially for those who aren't intimately familiar with the conflict. And let's be honest here, this isn't one of the most well-known wars of the ages.
No, I took a class on Franco-Prussian wars.
Oh, so then who won it?
The Francos or the Prussians? Nobody wins in war.
I know. It's a lose-lose all around. No, I'm just curious.
I have no idea.
Do you want to take a guess?
I would say the French.
You would be incorrect.
Well, I guess I'm wrong.
But that's what I'm saying. The Franco-Prussian War is not something that a lot of people know about. Although the reality is it's kind of the first modern war. It was the first introduction of machine guns, highly developed artillery, and things of that sort.
When was this war?
1870 to 1871.
Okay, interesting.
It followed the American Civil War, which towards the end of the American Civil War, there were some developments starting to take place that were much more modern. Trench warfare, for an example, most people think that was World War I. It actually started in the Civil War. Huh. It's also important to note that 2 major historical events, simulated rather abstractly in the design as well, took place during the Franco-Prussian War: the establishment of the Second German Reich and the founding of the French Third Republic. Here's something else that's kind of interesting. Everybody knows about the Third Reich, but a lot of people don't realize what was the First German Reich or the Second German Reich.
You're right. I have no idea.
Most people don't. Each of these events do have prerequisites before they can come into play, but they provide benefits to that particular side, including the increase of that side's hand size of cards. And that can be a big game changer. Overall, I enjoyed FP40 as it packs a lot of punch for a small footprint game. It's funny how a lot of gamers talk about the sheer volume of titles some of the Euro-style designers crank out. A good case in point, for an example, would be Rainer Knizia. Yet I'd bet dollars to donuts that Knizia hasn't published a third as many games as Joe Miranda. As with any designer with a tremendous amount of output, not all of them will be gems, and there are some stinkers along the way. I do understand that Miranda sometimes gets a knock for releasing a lot of the same old, just like Rainer Knizia. I can't say if I agree with that assessment one way or the other, but I can happily say that it seems as if Alan Emmerich and the gang at VPG always seem to draw some of the more unique and off-the-beaten-track designs from Joe's brain. Maybe that out-of-the-box thinking has something to do with the fact that VPG games don't come in boxes. I can't say this is one of the best war games I've ever played, or even one of the best VPG titles that are out there, but it's a good design, and it's one of those games that isn't just going to go up on the shelf because I've played it enough times to review it. If Joe Miranda hasn't knocked one out of the park with Franco-Prussian War 40, he has cracked a ringing double off the outfield wall. As this is the first title in the Von Clausewitz line, I'm interested in seeing where the series will go from here now that a great deal of the groundwork has been laid.
Very interesting. Yeah. You know, the one of the things that I like about the VPG games, or any games, is when they throw in that flavor text. It gives you a little historical background on everything.
They always do that. If you were in the midst of doing some playtesting on a Joe Miranda design for Victory Point Games.
Which one was that? The steampunk one?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, I'm wondering if they could combine the two, right?
Yes.
And have the second Reich go to the moon.
I think we've beaten that joke to death, haven't we? Because they weren't Nazis.
They're Nazis.
I know. They're Germans, but the joke is the Nazis on the moon. Or they're in Antarctica because some of them couldn't afford to go to the moon. That's a different game altogether.
I'm fresh out of Deutschmark, so I cannot go to the moon.
I know that you were playtesting for that one Joe Miranda title, the steampunk title from BPG.
Mm-hmm.
And they went back to the drawing board on that, as far as I know.
They did. They're going to just excite it up a little bit more and clean it up. Then I'll get to see it again, I'm hoping.
I would hope. Very nice. Very cool. Good game. Like I said, not the best VPG game out there, but it's going to get about a 7.
Okay.
7.5 probably. Right around there.
Well, my second review is on Wiz War, the 8th edition from Fantasy Flight Games.
The 8th edition?
Yes, it is the 8th edition.
Wow.
Originally designed by Tom Jolly and cleaned up, not cleaned up, but...
Reimagined
by Kevin Wilson. It just came out in 2012 for 2 to 4 players, ages 14 and up. Takes about an hour to play. Once you really get into it, though, it's much less time than that. It was originally developed by Tom Jolly in 1983.
Mm-hmm.
And this most recent incarnation from Fantasy Flight Games is the 8th edition of the game, which would indicate to me that it's probably a pretty good game. And it is.
Ah, there we go. For a second, I thought you were like...
I know, I could have broke either way.
And you'd have been wrong!
I've never played Wiz War before.
Me either.
I've seen it around in some of its many forms, but this is the first chance that I've had to actually play the game. The premise is simple. A couple of wizards get together in a labyrinth to duel. The first wizard to either gain 2 victory points or kill all the other wizards wins the game. Victory points can be gained by either killing another wizard or by stealing one of their treasures and bringing it back to your home square. The components are the same high quality I've come to expect from FFG. The figures are nicely detailed and they scream to be painted.
Paint me!
The only complaint I have is that the boards don't lay completely flat for me. They were slightly warped. So that did bug me a little bit. There's 4 boards. They're double-sided, so you can either play the original maze labyrinth layout from the original game or the new reimagined version.
Right.
Well, when I have it facing up the new way, they're kind of loose and will spin around and move around much easier.
Right, because they don't lay flat.
Exactly.
That's one thing that bugged me. Each player gets one in their color of their chosen wizard, and they're rotated randomly and placed next to each other to form the labyrinth for the game. In the center of each board is the player's home square, and there are two other squares on the board where each player places their treasures. Walls are scattered about, and there are two portals on each side of the fully assembled labyrinth, which can transport the wizard who goes through them to the corresponding portal on the other side of the board. One note about the figures, each wizard is interchangeable with the four colors. The colored base pops off, and you can put any wizard figure on it. This is cool because some cards allow your wizard to transform into another form. The game comes with five other figures that you can turn into if you cast the right spell. You can
form of a bucket of water.
Shape of an ice pick. Best yep. I could come up with.
Hey, it's a bucket of water. I mean, come on.
You can become a werewolf or a slime monster, a golem, a gnome, or a big dude. Actually, he's called the Big Man, but I like Big
Dude. I was going to say, is it from the Big Lebowski? It's the Dude?
Dude! Each form has its benefits and problems, and it's a pretty cool thing to be able to do. After assembling the labyrinth and placing your treasures and wizard on your home board, you'll need to assemble the magic deck. There are 8 separate schools of magic, but you'll only be using 4 of them per game. Each school is donated by an icon on the card, and you can choose them randomly or not, as you wish. But you'll need to always include the white cantrip school, as all wizards know these spells.
Duh. Yeah, very basic, easy.
Yes.
That's why it's a cantrip, not really a spell.
The selected cards are shuffled together to form the magic deck for the game. Each player is dealt 5 cards as their starting hand, and you're ready to begin by randomly choosing a starting player to take the first turn. A turn has 3 phases. The first is the time passes phase, in which you would remove an energy token from all the spells you're maintaining in front of you, remove a stun token if you're stunned. A nice stun effect. I like that.
Yeah, I just threw it in.
And resolve any ongoing spell effects. The second phase is where the action is. This is the movement and spell casting phase. A wizard may move up to 3 squares orthogonally, unless they're in some form which gives them extra movement.
Mm-hmm.
You can increase this by discarding a magic card that has an energy value printed on it. This will boost your movement by that energy amount for this turn. You can also cast spells, which come in many different flavors. Attack spells allow you to attack another wizard. You may make 1 attack per turn, unless, of course, a card allows you to make more.
Mm-hmm.
You may cast as many neutral and item spells as you wish. Energy spells are used to boost the strength of other spells, and counter spells are played against other wizards during their turn. Spells have different durations and different target types. Many must be made in line of sight of the wizard who's being attacked. The third phase is the discard and draw phase. You can draw up to 2 cards, but you can never have more than 7, and this includes cards that you have played in front of you as items that you're carrying or spells that you're maintaining. Now, I'm not going to go into all the rules here. They're not complex. There are many small interactions between the cards that do take a bit of interpretation. For the most part, the more trickier ones are covered in the rules, and there is a FAQ available on the FFG website, and I would recommend going in and reading. It's a 3-page document. It's just got some of the little more specific weird things that can pop up.
Sure, right.
Instead, I'll tell you about the final round of the last game I played against my son Matt.
Dun, dun.
I had him down to 4 life points while I was sitting at 14. Each wizard starts with 15, and there's these neat little life counter dials that allow you to keep track of it.
Mm-hmm.
On a side note, these dials actually go all the way up to 20, making them suitable for use in another popular dueling wizard game that I know of.
Which involves a lot of cards.
Which involves a lot of cards.
Which you would maybe gather with your friends to play.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So you can use it for Legend of the Five Rings.
Right. Now back to the story. My son had one of my treasures in his home square, giving him 1 victory point.
Mm-hmm.
I was carrying my other treasure around with me as he had stolen that one earlier. And I went to get it back.
This wizard just lugging around his big chest on his back.
The stands actually have a little slot on the back where you can pop the little treasure token in it so you can see your wizard carrying it around.
That is kind of funny.
I was going in for the kill, and I wasn't worried about my treasure at that point. I caught up with him 2 squares from his home base. I cast something that did 2 damage to him that brought him down to 2 life points, and that was the end of my turn.
Is the worm going to turn here suddenly? I have a feeling the worm is going to turn.
Matt then cast a spell to make me drop the treasure I was carrying. He picked it up, which basically ended his turn, because that happens when you pick up a treasure.
Okay.
I started my turn right next to him. I could have stabbed him with my dagger or thrown a large rock at him, but instead I cast a power thrust spell, which would take him down to -1 life.
Mm-hmm.
Matt had a counter spell, though, and deflected my power thrust with ease. At that point, I was doomed, as that was my only attack for the turn. Matt simply ran into his home square with my second treasure on his next turn, and he won the game.
Mm-hmm.
The moral of the story? Next time, just throw a big rock.
Kick him when they're down. Don't get too tricky. Just take him out.
Right. The game is fun. It's not an intense strategy game. It's meant to be fun more than anything else. There is strategy involved and some planning to do and spell combos to attempt. A lot depends on the luck of the draw. With the right cards and planning, it is possible to take out an enemy wizard in a single attack. I haven't had it happen yet, but it is possible. It's cool, though, and it's a fairly short game. It's meant to be a good time. There is player elimination, but again, most games are less than an hour, sometimes 30 minutes, once everybody knows how to play. My only source of annoyance with Wiz War is that you have to separate the cards back into their respective schools once the game is over,
mm-hmm.
so you can again reassemble it on the next game.
Right.
I'm debating on trying to play the game with each school in a separate draw pile and allowing players to draw from whatever pile they wish, which would cut down on the sorting time once the game's over. I'm just not sure how it would affect the gameplay until I try it out.
What if you discard your cards into specific piles? Wouldn't that make life easier?
It could. But if you go through the whole deck, you're supposed to just grab all the cards and shuffle them over, flip and keep going.
Okay.
Wiz War is a fun time regardless of the number of players. The more the merrier, of course, but since this is a direct confrontation game, I would avoid playing with younger and more sensitive gamers.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, I liked it a lot, and I'm hoping for some expansions in the future.
It can be easily expanded. It's an FFG game, so you know that's a very, very good possibility.
Yeah, I agree, and I've heard some talk about it already, and that would be cool. More schools to choose from, maybe throwing in 5 or 6 players. Yeah, it would be cool, especially since it plays so quickly.
Nice. When I think of Wiz War, first thing that popped into my head is in the Lord of the Rings when Gandalf
and Saruman
are going at it. Okay, so you guys are supposed to be wizards, right? But you both seem to only know one spell.
Right, to shoot each other across the room.
Slam the other guy. It's like, bam. Don't get me wrong. It's an awesome scene and great series of movies. But, you know, Gandalf is this great wizard, but he doesn't really know a whole lot of magic, does he?
No, not really.
Bazinga!
It's funny, I thought of something completely different involving drinking a lot of beer down on Rush Street.
Yes, I was going to make a goofball comment about Wiz, and then I figured, better not.
Well, I'm glad I was able to go there for it.
I took the high road on that one.
So yeah, good game. I liked it.
Anything else you wanted to tackle before we go?
Hunger Games coming out next week.
Yes, that's true. And I did finish the first book.
Did you? What did you think?
I thought it was all right.
I liked it a lot.
Thought it was okay.
Once you get past the teenage girl angst part of the whole series.
And I didn't even find a whole lot of
that. It's more pronounced in the second book.
I've heard that. And then I heard the third book is more of a letdown than the second.
Really?
From what I've heard. I don't know.
I haven't read the third one yet.
I thought it was pretty decent. Obviously, it's in absolutely no way an original concept. We talked about this before. I thought it was interesting enough. One issue I have is I'm not a huge fan of the first person novel.
Okay.
And it's kind of a lazy way to go about writing.
What?
Yes.
You're saying first person novelists are lazy.
No, I'm saying I'm not a big fan of it simply because I find it to be a bit lazier in the presentation than someone who's writing in a second or third person.
Because I don't find that at all.
Rather than sitting there and having to wonder, okay, so what's really going through this character's mind, it's spelled out for you.
That's true. But then you don't know what's going through the other characters' minds.
Which you wouldn't in a second or third person story either. You have to draw your own conclusions. But I understand it's a young adult book.
Right.
Many young adult books are written from that point of view. So I was very pleasantly surprised. It was nothing like I thought it was going to be.
Right. That was my exact feeling as well. I was thinking Scholastic books. Okay. How great can it be?
Yeah, but didn't Scholastic release Harry Potter? Weren't those Scholastic?
I have no idea.
I don't know. I think they may be. I never read them. So I'm just taking that from passing knowledge that I think they might have been Scholastic. It wasn't terrible. I finished it. So right there, that tells you something. Although normally I do finish a book unless it's really awful.
I'll always remember that story about you throwing the book across the room.
Yes, I've done that twice. Twice in my life have I finished reading a book where I took the book and I flung it across the room and I was pissed.
I believe one of them was one of the Game of Thrones novels, wasn't it?
No, not at all. One of them was, I can tell you the two books exactly. I mean, they still burn in my mind. Number one was the Elfstones of Shannara.
Okay, where she turned into the...
Yeah. You don't have to give it away. Right, okay. Yes, I thought that was...
That sucked.
Yeah, that totally sucked. And the other one was The Horse Whisperer.
Oh, that one I never read.
The book was all right. People had recommended it. And the movie hadn't come out yet. And I read it and I thought, are you kidding me? This is how you end the book? Seriously. The movie doesn't end the same way. And Robert Redford's famous for changing the ends to movies based on books. The Natural is a great example.
Right.
The Natural, in the book, he strikes out. He does actually take the money to throw the game. And then at the last moment, changes his mind in his like last at bat or whatever. Still strikes out. The story comes out that he did take money to throw the game. And he's banned from baseball. And all mention of his records and that he said are gone.
One of those feel-good endings.
Real feel-good. Well, the character is much different in the book than in the movie itself. Roy Hobbs in the book is just an egocentric bum, not like the Robert Redford character. Right. I prefer the Natural movie as opposed to the book.
Yeah.
That's for sure. So, all right. Enough of us pontificating on literature and film. People can look forward to more of that on the website as we talk about TV and movies and comics and video games and things like that.
Yep. Our main gist will always be Borden.
Always. That is the focus. That's why even the new additional sections that we're going to have some other contributors adding to are lower down on the website. Our focus is now and always will be on tabletop gaming. That's no right. doubt about that.
Yes.
And then next show, all we'll do is we'll talk about young adult books. Don't talk about games at all.
Here's my review of the Hunger Games movie.
Yep. There you have it. All right. So once again, everybody, thanks for giving us a listen and be back in 2 weeks for our next episode.
Thanks, everyone.
Elliot, you want to take us out?
Yep.
You've been listening to the Gaming Gang podcast with Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller. If you'd like to know more about the topics or games we discussed in this episode, please visit our website at www.thegaminggang.com. If you would like to have your opinion heard or have a gaming issue you'd like us to discuss on a future podcast, you can visit the Gaming Gang Guild on BoardGameGeek or call us at 480-779-7365 and leave a message. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please rate us on iTunes. Some of the games discussed on our show were provided to the Gaming Gang in the form of review copies. On behalf of everyone here at the Gaming Gang, thanks for listening.